All right, guys, good morning. Some of you sneaked in here after we did the announcements. You've timed it perfectly, haven't you? Get through that part. Man, how many of you want to help me start off on the right foot this morning with this series? You want to help me out? All right, well, here's a question for you. Whenever you think of the word change, you hear that word, how many of you in this room would say, man, I get excited about it. I love change. The more the better, bring it on. How many of you in here would say that's you? Any of you? It's like two of you, three, four, okay. How many of you in here are the complete opposite? And you say when you hear the word change and when it's brought up, immediately you just kind of resist it. You're hesitant. You may hate it. You fight it, whatever that, however that describes you. Is that you? How many of you in here? Okay. And then how many of you are in between? All right. Yeah, you know, I was thinking about this series as I was writing it. Everything changed. And I was thinking about that one word, change. And as I was thinking about this word and as I was just kind of racking my brain over it, I thought, man, what is one thing that we all could agree upon, given that we've all gone through different changes in our lives, and all of us are maybe going through changes currently, given that we're all wired differently in how we view change. And so I was just kind of rattling that through my brain, going, what is one thing we could agree upon regarding change? And as I thought about it, and as I dug deep, and as I just kind of sat there for a moment, I thought, okay, I think I know what it is, or at least one of them. And here's what I came up with. That whenever you have change introduced into your life, or at least you feel the challenge of change in your life, every one of us, whether you lean towards loving change and inviting it, or those that hate it, or somewhere in between, every one of us, in some way or another, have this brief pause in our perspective, in our lives in that, right? That there's just kind of this pause for each of us where we kind of soak it up, we kind of take, kind of taken back by it. And in that pause, it tells us a little bit about ourselves when it comes to change. And here's what it is. Is that for each and every one of us, we have a lens that we look at life through. True? We look at different areas in our lives. We have categories in our lives. We have all these different things in our lives that we look at life through. And these lenses, and there's categorical lenses and one ultimate lens, I think. These lenses that we look through really are what are defined as our perspective. And whenever we look at life, we look at, for example, our job, and whenever we look at government, whenever we look at church, whenever we look at marriage and finances, on and on and on, we look at things and we have a perspective, we have a lens as to how we view things should be or the way things are. And so whenever anyone comes into your world or into my world and they start challenging our perspective, they bring something to us that to us is different from the way we think things are, the way things should be, there is automatically within each and every one of us this pause where we think, oh, wait a minute, right? Where you just kind of sit back, and for some of us that really resist change a lot, you kind of go, I'm going to fight it immediately. For some of us that are a little more moderate, maybe you're a little level-headed, and for others of us, at a minimum, even if you like change, you still have this moment inside of you where you say, what about this? And for each and every one of us, that's just how we deal with change. True? You agree with that? There's just that pause. Now, the reason why that takes place in all of our lives is because for each of us, all of our perspectives are formed by the information that we know and by the situations or experiences that we have had in life, right? That somehow they're all jumbled together, and from this, we form a perspective based on how we view work, how we view family, how we view this, how we view that. And so when someone comes into that and they challenge that with new information or new experiences possibly, all of us tend to just take a step back and pause. And the reason really at the end of the day, it's because all of our perspectives really are bedded on or based on or against the backdrop of what I would best, I guess, communicate in an acronym of WIFM. And that's not a radio station, okay? It means what's in it for me, right? You ever heard that before? But the truth is that whenever you establish your perspectives, whenever you come down on the way you view things and the way things ought to be, should be, would be, could be, and all that stuff, is that it's really all grounded upon a filter, a bottom line background filter that you have and that I have, that's very individual, that's very personal, and at the end of the day, it's what you would call WIFM. And so that's why when someone approaches you and says, hey, you need to change this in your life, immediately you go, oh, time out. Or no, you need to go try this. Whoa, time out. And immediately you're thinking, well, how is this going to affect me? Now, the truth of the matter is we have perspectives in all areas of life. And we also have perspectives as it pertains to God. True? We all have a perspective of God, and specifically Jesus. And just to pick on myself first, I want to tell you a little bit about my perspective of Jesus. And some of you know this. Some of you, if you're our guest, you may not know this. But for me personally, I was born and bred in the home of a pastor. And so from birth, And from infancy, I went into a nursery of sorts in church life. And so my entire life, I have been exposed to and been around the things of God, the things of Christianity, and the things of church. And so when I think back about my perspective as it has formed over time and as it has continued to evolve and change, I can think back to the first days of my life. And we're going to put a picture up here. And I think back to certain pictures or scenes that that I remember were the first ones that I viewed. And these pictures are some that probably you've seen, like this. Joseph and Mary and baby Jesus. Any of you remember this? Sweet baby Jesus, right? I'm thinking of that movie, whatever that movie is, Talladega Nights or something. But this is what... Should I say that in church? I don't know. But anyway, but here's what we do is that we seriously, when we grow up as children, we're introduced to these images of Jesus, these stories of Jesus, the nativity scenes of Jesus, all these things. And so this is it. Now, there's another one right here. Here's another one. And do you remember the picture Bible? Any of you? Did you have that? Okay. All those Christians and churchy kids, we had that. But growing up, we had picture Bibles, although I think that's a cartoon. And we're introduced to these types of things about Jesus. And so as we grow up and as I grew up, I had a perspective of Jesus, of what I was introduced to in knowledge, what I was introduced to in experiences, and my perspective of Jesus started to grow and form from that. Now, the truth is that you have the same. All of us here have a perspective of Jesus. All of us here have in some way been introduced to Jesus. Maybe it was like mine where it was early on in life. Maybe for some of us, it's actually been here recent for you in life. But for all of us, we have a perspective of the way we view Jesus based on information we know, based on experiences, and really even the lack of them. And so for you, let's put that picture back up there. When you think of Jesus, maybe your interaction and perspective of Jesus is like this picture here that I would refer to as the Holy Jesus. And this is the picture that I remember possibly seeing in a grandmother's house or someone like that, where you have Jesus with radiance behind him, the deep blue eyes, the long hair. Now, I don't get the beard. It's the funky upside down V deal. But this is the Holy Jesus from my perspective, okay, what I saw. So maybe that's yours. Let's go to the next one. Maybe for all of you that grew up in the 70s, okay, any of you here? Yeah, this is the hippie Jesus, I think, with the clouds or flowers, I think, on the front of Time magazine from back in the 70s. Maybe your perspective of Jesus is, let's keep going, this one, the suffering Jesus, the crown of thorns, the cross, the rope around his neck, you know, all these things. Let's keep rolling. The next one is this. This is maybe the way you think of Jesus. This is bobblehead Jesus, okay? And I actually had a brother that used to have a bobblehead Jesus on his dash. I don't know why. But he did. But here's bobblehead Jesus. And then here's the last one. And this is maybe hipster Jesus, the cool Jesus, wearing Ray-Bans, you know, the whole deal. But here's my point, okay? Is that for every one of us, we're in this journey of establishing a perspective of Jesus, our information that we know, the experiences we have in life. And for many of us, when you think through what Jesus looks like, the big deal about this is that at the end of the day, it shapes the way you act in regards to God and in regards to Jesus. Now, the thing about all of us that I just said a minute ago is so true even about Jesus is that all of us build our perspectives again with this filter, with this grid of what's in it for me. And so for myself and my life, and I've seen this definitely looking back on my life, and I probably will continue to see it as I age and as I mature spiritually, but as I look back on my life, the perspective that I had of Jesus was I had a with-em Jesus for much of my life. I had this perspective of Jesus that when I thought of him, I thought of Jesus in maybe one of those pictures that you just looked at with me. But when I thought about him, I thought of Jesus was someone that was in heaven and in the Bible and in stories and in words that I'd heard about and in paintings and pictures. But when I thought about Jesus, I thought about Jesus as to what he could do for me. And so what happened to us is throughout most of my life, when I would think about Jesus, pray to Jesus, talk to Jesus, the way I would approach Jesus was, Jesus, will you give me this? Will you give me that? Will you get me out of this spanking on the way home? I'm in the back of my van that my mom's threatened to deliver when I get home. Seriously, I did this at about 4 or 5 years of age, maybe older. Will you provide me with this car that I want and convince my dad I need it? Will you provide me with this job and this promotion? Will you provide me with this chick that I want to date? Will you provide me with this house? Will you provide me? Do you follow me? And for all of us, believe it or not, I believe we start off at a minimum with this idea of Jesus, this perspective of Jesus based on what we know and what we've experienced. It is truly, really a Jesus that's based on what's good for me, what I can get from him, what he can do for me. And I'll just go ahead and cut to the chase and share this with you. The truth of the matter is, when you look at the scripture, that is not the Jesus of the Bible. But, sadly, but it's just part of life. For most of us, at some point in our lives, and maybe for some of us here in this room, maybe for you today, that is the Jesus that is your Jesus. He is the Witham Jesus. He is the what's in it for me Jesus. And that's the Jesus that you come to church to listen to and you filter everything through. That is the Jesus you engage every day. That is the Jesus that you picture in your mind and in your heart. That is your Jesus. But that's not the real Jesus. You know, the intriguing thing about Scripture is, and what I love about it, in midst of all the challenges people throw at it, is that the Bible is so honest. That's what I love about it. There are things written in the Bible that honestly, if you were trying to make this stuff up, you would never include it in the Bible. You would never include it. And there are so many things that I could share with you, but I want us to look at something today that I think runs parallel with many of us about how we evolve in our perspective of Jesus by looking at the lives of the disciples. Now, if you have your Bibles, turn with me to the Gospel of Mark. It's the second gospel in the New Testament. Go ahead and flip to chapter 8. And I'm going to give you a little background here about the disciples. You know, for many, many, many years, Jewish little boys and Jewish little girls were born in Israel to parents, of course. And these parents, when they raised these children, they would talk to them about their nation. And they would tell them about how Israel was founded. And ultimately it was founded years and years and years ago. And little kids sitting on their parents' knee would be told the story between a covenant between God and a man named Abraham. And then they would tell them about the Exodus, about how that Moses went in and to Pharaoh in Egypt and said, "Let my people go." And after a series of events, that God brought the children of Israel out and later on, years later, brought them into what's considered the Promised Land. And as Jewish little boys and little girls were being raised, they were being told these stories. And as they would read the scripture, the Old Testament, Genesis through Deuteronomy, Numbers, all these books of the Bible that they had, the Torah and the prophets and others, here's what they would all be told. They would say that God made a promise. And through the prophet Isaiah, he prophesied one day that one day there would be a king. And this king would sit on David's throne and he would reign forever. And the reason why this was such a big deal, guys, listen, was because Israel at this time, and especially at the time of Jesus, had been in captivity of Rome. Rome oppressed them. They taxed them to death. They made them feel like that they were, well, in captivity. And they were able to do some things, but in truth, they were not free. They were not in power. And so these parents, when they raised their kids, they'd say, "Guys, I'm telling you, you need to look for the one who's coming. You need to look for the promised one, the Messiah, the one that Isaiah speaks of and that all the other prophets speak to and point to. He's coming. We need to watch for him." And so these kids would grow up always looking. Well, the same was true during the day of Jesus and for the disciples. And so the disciples, actually, their story is kind of unique because Jesus, when you look at Mark chapter 1, as we work through it, what you find is that Jesus started his ministry when he went, was baptized by John the Baptist. He went out into the wilderness for 40 days. He came back after John the Baptist was arrested. And then he started going out and recruiting. And the very ironic thing about this is that rabbis in their day never approached people to say, "Follow me." Spiritual teachers, rabbis. But they were always approached by people to them saying, "Can I follow you?" But Jesus took authority. He went to some fishermen. He said, "Hey, leave your family business, follow me." They said, "Okay." They went with him. He went to a tax collector, a guy that was taxing people to death. He was a traitor in his own nation. He said, "Get up and follow me. Quit your job." He said, "Okay." And Jesus began doing this. And as Jesus started doing this, Jesus started performing miracles. Jesus started teaching. He started speaking with authority in synagogues that made people go, "Who is this guy?" Jesus started going up to the Pharisees and the others as they attacked him. And they would ask him questions. And Jesus would turn them on their head and make them look stupid. And Jesus did all these things and performing miracles. And when all this started happening, the disciples, these women, these followers, these crowds around Jesus started thinking, "Wow, is he it?" And so we pick up at John chapter 8, verse 27. I want you to look at this very unique day in the life of Jesus. Jesus has just made a buffet for thousands of people out of a few loaves of bread and fish, okay? He just healed a blind man. And so Jesus is in a discussion with his disciples, and here was the question he asked in verse 27. He said, "And Jesus went on with his disciples to the villages of Caesarea Philippi. And on the way, he asked his disciples, 'Who do people say that I am?' And here's what the disciples told him. And they told him, 'John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and other ones the prophets, one of the prophets.' And so he looked at them and he said, 'But who do you say that I am?' And Peter speaks up as always, and he says, 'You are the Christ. You are the promised one. You are the Messiah. You are the anointed one.' And then he looks at me and he said, Jesus strictly charged them, as Mark notes it, to tell no one about him." Now, in this moment, this is the first time that Jesus declares who he is. In his life, this is the first time. He's been performing miracles. He's been teaching. He's been doing all these things where people are speculating, wondering, and all this. But finally, he asks Peter, and Peter says, "You're the Christ." In one of the other gospel accounts, Jesus said, "You're right. You're not smart enough to know that. God told you that. But don't tell anyone." And so this is what Peter said to him, or what Jesus said to Peter. Now, as soon as Jesus says this, this is an interesting thing. Look with me in verse 31. "And then Jesus began to teach them that the Son of Man," referring to himself, "must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and killed, and after 3 days rise again." And he said this plainly. Now, here was the problem. These Jewish kids, now men and disciples, as they were following Jesus, they finally had him where they wanted him. He finally said, "I'm the Christ. I'm the Messiah. I'm the one you've been told about as a child. I'm the one you're looking for," and all this. And here was the backdrop for them. When they viewed the Messiah coming, and their picture of the Messiah was that he would come and he would free them all from Rome, that he would go sit physically on a throne where King David used to sit, as Isaiah the prophet said. And so here Jesus is and says, "I'm the dude." And then the next verses that we just read is that Jesus looks at him and says, "But here's what you need to know about me. I'm going to be killed." Guys, I'm telling you, for them, they thought, there is no way. And actually, where we pick up right here, where we left off, it says, "And Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him." Right? Rebuke him. One of the other gospel accounts records what Peter said. Listen to what he said. "Far be it from you, Lord. This shall never happen to you." Why? Because he's the Messiah. He's the one that's going to reign. He's the one that's going to sit on the throne of David. He's the one that's going to free us from our oppression. He cannot suffer. He can't die. And then look at Jesus' reaction. "But turning and seeing his disciples, he rebuked Peter and he said this, 'Get behind me, Satan.'" Wouldn't you like that? Jesus said that. Now look how he continues. He said, "Look, for you are not setting your mind on the things of God, but on the things of man." And guys, I want to tell you right here, as clear as ever, the disciples had a perspective of Jesus that was with them. What's in it for me? Jesus, this can't happen to you. Why? Because then you won't reign. We won't be free. We won't be able to do all these other things and this deal. And so Jesus that they had before, they liked better than this Jesus. And Peter made that clear. And Jesus told him clearly, "You're not right." Then look at how Jesus continues. Verse 34. "And then he called to him the crowd with the disciples." And here's what Jesus said. "If any of you would come after me or follow me, you must deny yourself," or himself, "take up his cross and follow me." To which when the disciples and all the crowd heard this, they had to just sit there and go, okay, this is getting weirder by the second. Cross? Do you know what a cross is, Jesus? I mean, surely you know that when you walk around the main thoroughfares, you see men there hanging on this cross. That when you walk through and around the grocery stores, if you will, you see people hanging on the cross. When you walk by, you can catch at eye level the people on the cross that are dying. What do you mean? Deny yourself, take up your cross. And Jesus continues. He says, "For whoever would save his life will" what? "Lose it. But whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it." And then he concludes, "For what does it profit a man to gain the whole world and forfeit his life?" I just want to tell you, and I don't think I understand this fully for sure. I know I don't. I don't think any of us do. But when this day occurred in the life of Jesus with his disciples, and they had this whiff and perspective of the Messiah, this absolutely shattered and challenged every category they possibly could understand about the Messiah. Look with me and continue in the story. Chapter 9, verse 30. After some other things took place, some really cool things with Jesus, here was Jesus again. They went on from there and passed through Galilee, and he did not want anyone to know, for he was teaching his disciples, saying to them again, "The Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men, and they will kill him. And when he is killed, after 3 days, he will rise." Now watch Mark's note here, verse 32. This is so awesome. "But they did not understand the saying and were" what? "Afraid to ask him." No one wanted to be the next Peter and be called Satan, right? I mean, it's like, dude, I am not going to go and ask him. This makes no sense to me, because the Messiah I keep thinking of is not that Messiah. And Jesus says this is what's going to happen. And so no one would ask him. But again, clearly, they were just confused. And so as you continue to move through the gospel, as you continue to flip through pages, then you see a third time where Jesus, on the road to Jerusalem, says, "Hey, guys, they're going to actually spit on me, mock me, flog me, kill me." And again, it says they could not grasp these things. They couldn't understand them. Like, what are you talking about, Jesus? This is not the Jesus you're to be. This is not the Messiah. This is not him. And what I find so funny is right after Jesus, this just tells you, I mean, we're all like this, okay? Just look at it through the lens of the disciples. Right after Jesus says this, James and John, with their mama, approaches Jesus. And they say, "Jesus, will you do for us whatever we want you to do?" Talking about what's in it for me, right? And Jesus says, "What do you want?" And they said, "How about me and Bubba sit at your right and your left in your glory?" That's what they said. And of course, Jesus looks at him and says, "Guys, you don't even know what you're asking for. You don't even understand. You don't get it." That right after he says he's going to die, they're saying, "Can I sit at your right and your left?" They're still thinking the kingdom. And so as they enter into Jerusalem, of course, you've heard this. And today marks what's called Palm Sunday, where Jesus actually has a colt. He's put on the back of a colt. He's led through into Jerusalem. And I didn't put these verses on the screen, but in Mark chapter 11, verse 10, it says this: "All the people before and followed were shouting, 'Hosanna, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Blessed is the coming kingdom of our father David. Hosanna in the highest.'" And as the disciples followed Jesus, and as they walked through in his triumphal entry, every one of them had to be thinking, "He's back." Maybe that was those statements he was saying about death were a parable. Maybe it's just something we didn't understand, because these people, just like us, are crying out a military cry that he is going to reign in the place of King David. You see, their perspective of Jesus was about what he could do for them. Their perspective of Jesus was all about what would happen in their lives if, in fact, he was able to get into power. And so as we continue to move through the Gospels, move all the way into chapter 14, right after Judas has gone and made a deal with the chief priest, Jesus actually takes his disciples to an upper room. You remember this story? He tells them to prepare it, and they were going to celebrate Passover together. This was something they had probably done a couple times before. And in the Passover meal, Jesus, in verse 22, Mark 14, 22, it says, "And they were eating, and he took the bread, and after blessing it, he did something kind of weird. He broke it, he gave it to them, and he said, 'Take, this is my body.'" To which, when he did this, the disciples had to be thinking, "Oh, my grief. What are you doing? This makes no sense. Why is now Passover about you? This is, I mean, you know, I mean, really, it just didn't make sense." And then he continues, and he thought that was bad. He continues, verse 23, "And then he took a cup, and when he had given thanks, he gave it to them, and they all drank of it. And then after they drank of it, then he said to them, 'This is my blood.'" Imagine that, right? "Of the new covenant, which is poured out for many." And so Jesus just takes something that was a tradition that they followed in celebrating the Exodus and what God had done for them years and years and years before. And he says, "Actually, this bread is me. Actually, this blood, this wine is representative of my blood." And so right after that, they sing a hymn. They go into the garden. The prayer of anguish takes place with Jesus and the Father and the other guys snoring and sleeping. And finally, Judas comes, betrays Jesus. They take him before the courts of the high priest. And the high priest and them are just jockeying around, trying to get a story to get rid of Jesus. And they couldn't get stories to match up. And so finally, the chief priest looks at Jesus and he says, "Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed?" And Jesus said, "Yes." And when Jesus said this, he tore his robe, the chief priest did. And he said, "He is blaspheming. He is making himself a deity. He is making himself God. He deserves death. There is no other witness that we need." The next morning, Friday morning, they take him to Pilate. And Pilate hears him and he investigates. He asks him some questions. And he was a Roman governor of that area. He sends him over to Herod. Herod doesn't find any fault in him. He sends him back to Pilate. And finally, Pilate says, okay, these people are crazy, but I'm going to try to just get this off my back. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to say, hey, as I've done in the past at Passover, I'll have free to you one person. You can have Barabbas, who's a thug, or you can have Jesus. And they cried out, give us Barabbas. He said, well, what am I to do with Jesus? Crucify him. By this point, all the disciples had scattered, right? When Judas came and betrayed him, Peter said he would die for him, yet he denied him. All the disciples agreed they would die for him, but they ran off. They were all hiding. And here Jesus is standing before all these people, and they're screaming for his blood. They're screaming for his life. They're screaming, crucify him, crucify him. And so finally, in chapter 15, you look at verse 15 with me. Here's what happened. So Pilate, wishing to satisfy the crowd, released for them Barabbas, and having scourged or flogged Jesus, meaning taking the whip of the cat of nine tails and strapping it on every open place of flesh of his body. And Jesus at this point, guys, was completely naked. Wherever this would cling to and rip away flesh, that's what Jesus was going through. They scourged him and then they delivered him to be crucified. Verse 16, and the soldiers led him away inside the palace. And they called together the whole battalion. And then they clothed him in a purple cloak. They twisted a crown of thorns. They put it on him. And then they began to salute him. Hail, King of the Jews. And then they were striking him with a reed and spitting on him and kneeling down in homage to him. And when they had mocked him, they stripped him of the purple cloak, put his own clothes on him, and then they led him out to be crucified. In verse 24 and in all the Gospels, it says that once he arrived at Golgotha, here was the way they described the crucifixion. And they crucified him. The reason why they described it this way was because this is what everyone knew that was reading their accounts. Crucifixion meant 7-inch nails, likely, pierced through the most sensitive areas of your body, in your hands and in your feet. He was then taken and attached to a crossbeam of around 100 pounds. He was hoisted up into the air. He was dropped down violently into the ground. Likely, Jesus was not way up in the air on a cross. He was likely just inches off the ground to where people could look him almost in the eye. That's the way it was. And Jesus hung there, crucified on the cross. Look with me in verse 33. And then in the sixth hour, which was noon, had come, there was darkness over the whole land. That'd be kind of eerie, wouldn't it? Everything pitch black. Until the ninth hour, 3 o'clock. And at the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, which means, my God, why have you forsaken me? That in the midst of darkness, in the midst was taking place on the cross, and as the disciples, those that were brave enough to watch, maybe in the women, as they were right there looking at Jesus, they were all sitting there, all watching this, and Jesus cries out to God, and he says, God, where are you? Why'd you leave me here alone? And I think for many of us, it's hard to understand, but here's the truth of it. What Jesus went through on that cross was not just the torture of the nails and the torture of the suffering and all that he was going through from the flogging. What Jesus suffered the most from, that his Father, that he had had intimacy with and unity with forever, was all of a sudden squelched. And so when Jesus cried this out, a bystander, hearing it, behold, said this about it. It said, hey, he's calling Elijah. Verse 36, and someone ran and filled a sponge with sour wine, put it on a reed, and gave it to him to drink, saying, wait, let us see whether Elijah will come to take him down. Verse 37, watch this. And Jesus uttered a loud cry and breathed his what? Last. And here was what Jesus said. With every last ounce of breath in him, Jesus cried out, it is finished. And he died. In verse 38, and the curtain of the temple was torn in two and from top to bottom. And when the centurion who was standing right there at the base of the cross, when this happened, he stood facing Jesus. He saw what happened and how he breathed his last breath. And watch what he says. Truly, this man was the son of who? God. Guys, the disciples had a whiffum view of the Messiah. The disciples, in the beginning, had this desire of what Jesus could do for them, what Jesus could give to them. But I'm telling you, at the cross, that whiffum view of the Messiah, that whiffum view of Jesus, died on that cross. At the experience of the cross, Every hope, every dream that the disciples had leading up to it was shattered. All hope was lost. All hope was gone because the Messiah, the one that was going to sit on the throne, the one that was going to reign forever, the one that was going to free them from Rome was now dead. He was gone. You see what the disciples wanted? What the disciples thought that they needed was a Messiah that would do things for them. What the disciples really believed was that I want a Jesus. I want a Messiah. That when I ask for that job, when I ask for that promotion, when I ask to sit at his right or his left, when I ask for fame, when I ask for all this, that he'll give it to me. But the Messiah that they received was one that was so much greater than the one that they ever believed was possible. You see, the Messiah, the Jesus, the true, real Jesus, was not a Jesus that we're to say, what's in it for me? But he is a Jesus based on what he did for us at the cross, where we say, I worship you. You see, for each and every one of us, we all start off with this whiffum idea of Jesus. We all start off with our perspective of what can Jesus do for me? And, you know, if I rub the genie in the bottle just right and wish just right and all that, that he'll give me what I want. And in some ways, the disciples' view of the Messiah was the same. And I'm telling you, that was my view for many, many years. And likely, that is some of your views even today. The Jesus that you think of, the perspective of the Jesus that you know, is not the true Jesus. Because the Jesus that you want is a Jesus that's all about you. The real Jesus of the Bible and the Jesus that the disciples came in contact with and they understood at the cross was not that Jesus. He was the Jesus that was worthy of your life and of your worship. And if you recall when I read earlier in Mark chapter 8, verse 34, when Jesus called everyone around him, he said these words, right? If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. For what does it profit a man to gain the whole world and forfeit his life? When the cross took place in the life of these disciples, it made sense. What Jesus said to Peter when he said, the things you're focused on are not the things of God, but the things of man, it made sense. That the cross changed everything. The death of Jesus changed everything in their lives. And I'm telling you today, until you personally experience the cross and what Jesus did for you out of love, you will never truly know Jesus. Because if you think in your mind that Jesus is one that's all about you, you have the wrong Jesus. But when you understand what Jesus did for you out of love and how he paid the penalty for your sin, what separates you from a holy God in heaven, when you come to experience that which is otherwise known through the death of Jesus on the cross, that's when you experience Jesus. And guys, I so want that for every one of you because it will change everything. You know, years ago, I used to think about when I thought about seasons of the year, and this is a little off topic, but I think it illustrates the point, that I used to rank seasons of the year like this. I'd say fall is the best, spring is right up there with it, then summer, and then winter was nowhere to be found. I think if I talk to God, just divide it in thirds and we'd be good, okay? However, one time I went on a skiing trip, the very first one I ever went on, and it was in Vail, Colorado. Any of you ever been snow skiing, snowboarders out here? Yeah. And when I went out there and I was out on the mountain peaks after I went down the bunny hills a few times, I remember looking out over the snow-capped mountains. And I remember what it was like going screaming down, whether falling, tumbling, or actually on my feet, down the mountain. And I remember what it was like to say, you know what? My perspective has changed. You know, I had heard about how much fun it was from other people to go snow skiing. I had heard that snow actually had value, but I'd never experienced it. And see, for many of us today, when we think of Jesus, we think of him like a story. We think of him like on the pages of a book. We think of him as like a picture. We think of him very, very impersonal. And the reason for that, I'm just telling you, the reason for that, and the reason why your perspective of Jesus is so just jacked, like mine has been, is because you have not understood and experienced the cross. Our perspectives are formed by knowledge and experiences together. And my desire more than anything for all of you, and my prayer through this entire message and series has been this. I want for what you know about the Jesus of the Bible to intersect with an experience of the cross, of what he did for you. So that you may say, like Thomas said when he saw him after the empty tomb, my Lord and my God. And just as the women saw him after the empty tomb and they fell at his feet and they said, and they worshiped him, that is my desire for you. And I'm telling you, that will never happen with a whiff of Jesus. One last thing I want to lead you through, and Cody and Heather are going to come and sing a song. This is an awesome time because together we get to celebrate Jesus. Personally, we get to experience him, and then corporately we get to celebrate him together. And one of the ways we get to do this is what's called the Lord's Supper and communion. And after the death of Jesus, the disciples looked back on this, no doubt. Paul wrote about this, and we're about to look at this in 1 Corinthians, where they looked back on what Jesus said at that final supper the night before his crucifixion. And they write about it, and they're saying, now it makes sense. We are far more excited about a dying Messiah than a reigning Messiah physically on the throne of David. And because of that, we celebrate him. And so as our host team comes forward, we're going to pass around these baskets. And I want to ask you to take a little cup of juice and a cracker. And then they're going to sing a song, lead us in this song. And during this time of the song, I want to ask you that you just reflect on what Jesus has done for you, how much he loves you, what he did for you, the real Jesus. And I want to ask you this. If you're here today and you say, man, I have a what's in it for me, Jesus. I want to ask you to do this. I want for you to just say, God, thank you for the real Jesus. And I don't want to continue to carry around this view of Jesus of what he can do for me. I want to carry around a view of Jesus and experience a view of Jesus that is real, of a Jesus that I can worship. And I want you to do that because that's what he's calling you to do. And y'all go ahead and bring those forward. And I'm just going to read these verses as the baskets are being passed around. Paul said in 1 Corinthians 11:23, he said, for I received from the Lord what I also deliver to you, that the Lord Jesus, on the night when he was betrayed, he took bread. And when he had given thanks, he broke it and said, this is my body, which is for who? Can y'all say it with me? It's for you. It's for me. Do this in remembrance of me. In the same way, Jesus took the cup, and after supper saying, this cup is the new covenant in my blood. Do this as often as you drink it in remembrance of me. Now, I want to read this last verse, and I want for you just to think about this, okay? And if this is distracting, I apologize, but you'll have time to reflect on this in just a moment. But in verse 26, Paul said this, for as often as you eat this bread and drink the cup, you proclaim the Lord's what? Say with me, death until he comes. Guys, we don't celebrate Jesus because of him giving you that promotion. We don't celebrate Jesus because of him getting you out of a spanking like I did. You know, we don't celebrate Jesus for all those reasons. I mean, those things are fine, but listen, the reason why we remember Jesus, the reason why we celebrate Jesus is because of his death for you and his death for me. And so in this moment, as they lead us, y'all go ahead, I just pray that you'll just reflect and you'll take of the juice and take of the bread and remember Jesus.